DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology. I'm Chipone Chimbelu, standing in for Sulfik Albani. On today's show, we'll get to hear about how researchers are working on making our roads safer and more predictable by using technology that allows cars to communicate with each other. We'll also hear about a rather worrying health trend in Germany. Not only is the number of cases of gonorrhea rising, but resistance to current treatments is also increasing. So we'll get to hear about what health workers are doing to fight this worrying trend. All that and more right here on Spectrum. This week, Google retires Google Reader, a service which allowed users to store and sort through unmanageable amounts of web content. Google announced it would shut down Google Reader on July 1st in early March. The internet giant didn't give a reason for its decision to shut down its service, but several media outlets have said that it was because Google was unable to generate a lot of ad revenue from the service. Whatever the case, Google's decision has left a lot of users unhappy and desperately hunting for other solutions. Jesse Wingard has a report on some of the alternatives.
For years, Google's RSS service, Google Reader, allowed users to track news updates on sites they chose to follow. Essentially, it allowed them to collect as many sites as they wanted on one platform. But earlier this year, rather unexpectedly, Google announced it would shut down the RSS service on July 1. So millions of people were left with just a few months to find an alternative. Fortunately, there are solutions out there. Lars-Erik Bolstad is the head of core technology at European web browser developer Opera.
I think over the past couple of years, we've seen that many of these content publishers also use other channels. So RSS is not the only way you can do that, you know, to keep track of a lot of sites.
Google Reader's demise has created a gold rush among startups and other tech companies vying to be the next big feed reader for users who want to have all the websites they follow on a single platform. And with the ever-rising numbers of mobile devices, people have been quick to turn to several mobile apps as alternatives. Unlike Google Reader, which has been outdated in terms of its display and interface, some of the more recent apps are better adapted to today's technology. Marcy McHugh, the head of content and communication at Flipboard, the company that creates a news aggregator app of the same name, explains some of the features of their solution.
You can flip through it, literally turning the pages with your finger of different stories of the day, popular items that are being shared, news that's happening or breaking in the world. So it gives you a really easy, fast way to consume the news of the day. And we also let you connect to social networks. So you can connect Flipboard to your Facebook, to your Twitter feed, to your Google Circles, to Instagram, to all the things that are popular social conversations that you want to also view in this magazine-like format.
Some 60 million people have downloaded the app, McHugh says, but users who are choosing to use alternatives to Google Reader like Flipboard, Feedly or Digg need to migrate their content, as Oprah's Bolstad explains.
I know that Google have made it very easy to export, you know, your feeds and your subscription settings and other services make it very easy to import directly from Google Reader. So migrating your subscription settings to a new service seems to be very easy.
Marcy McHugh says as long as Google Reader users migrate their content before the shutdown, feeds they have worked hard to collect won't be lost.
Google Reader is not available any longer, so you won't be able to adjust those feeds or edit them, but you will be able to enjoy them the way you always have. It will be updated and refreshed.
And what happens if you miss the deadline?
Yeah, if you don't move it before it shuts down, we won't have any way of finding it. So unfortunately, if you don't connect Google Reader to Flipboard in advance, then there's no way to get to Google Reader.
Despite the fact that Google has chosen to shut down its RSS service, the number of users of such services has been rising as more and more use mobile devices like smartphones and tablet PCs. According to Bolstad at Opera, there is an increasing desire for aggregator reader services demanding a greater reader experience. And Google Reader's demise may have just allowed millions of people to discover other alternatives like Feedly, Dig and Feeder.
That was Jesse Wengard with a report on some of the alternatives to Google Reader, which Google is shutting down this week. There's a lot to be said about data, from stories about how US authorities have been spying on our information online to the humongous amounts of money that companies like Google and Facebook are making selling user data. Some people have even gone as far as saying that data is the new oil. And with all this talk, it's easy to take it for granted. But some critics fear that much of the data isn't easily available and accessible to internet users. Among them is Christian Kreutz, one of the founders of the German chapter of the Open Knowledge Foundation. I spoke with him and began by asking him whether there's a difference between open data and big data.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. It's completely different. Whereas big data, we're talking about large amounts of data itself. It's kind of a specification. Open data means that we're doing something with it. We're giving it freely available, or we can access it freely. So there's a completely different notion behind it.
When it comes to data being out there, there's a problem with people accessing it and being able to understand it. What kind of issues, what are the challenges people have in accessing the data that is available on the internet?
I think one difficulty as a first step is that there's too little data available freely, that I can really freely use it, download it as a raw format and use it for my purposes. There's, if you look at it, there's a huge wave and everybody talks about it, but if you really look at how much is available, and interesting data especially, there is not so much available as we hope, and there will be hopefully soon more available. And the second step, I think the difficulty is, you know, to then understand and to have the competency or to understand the skills to do something out of it, of course. This is also difficult.
What is the problem with this data, technically speaking? What is the issue that's maybe what's the challenge in making this data accessible? Is it because it's in a different format, or is it because it's not in a language that people can understand? What is the issue?
Yeah, to give you an example, if you look at budget data, and if you take a city who gives you the whole budget data as a PDF of, say, 3,000 pages, you know, if you now want to get a detailed information once in a while, you look at it, or in a specific case, you have to scroll to all the pages. And you really have to know where something is. If you have this in raw data, you can put it into a database, you can query it, you can search or you can compare, you can actually interact with the data. You can really, you know, manipulate it or, let's say, analyze it to your purposes.
Right. And what is the Open Knowledge Foundation trying to do to change the fact that data is not as easily accessible as it should be?
First of all, for us, it is very important to praise open license models. You know, for us, it is important that once you really push data openly, that you give it available free, but you also use the right license so you can, you know, without any constraints, can use it. That's important for us. And then we try to make projects or develop tools where you can easily access this information and do stuff with it.
And what kind of projects are you developing right now, like in Africa or elsewhere? Is there anything that you're working on?
I mean, we are a big organization in various countries, and we're working on different levels. For instance, I look at what the German government is spending on their aid, and then I have colleagues, other interesting people who are working then locally. How is this money then spent, or how can you see this in the budget there, or does it make any difference? So we start just at the beginning there, but I think if you build these bridges between the data flows, particularly financial flows, it becomes very interesting.
So what is the difference between the data that's available and, say, the data that your colleagues in the field are collecting? Is there any difference in terms of what you get?
Oh, it really depends. You can also have in Germany horrible data available on just a PDF, and it can be on this local level here in Germany and some in an African country locally. I think it really depends. But let's say larger organizations also, they provide often now raw data in bigger formats, you know, but in open formats, you know. But in most cases, it's PDF, and this is very difficult because I can't interact with the data easily.
What would be an easier way to provide this data for people to be able to interact with it?
I think the PDF, I'm always repeating it because I think it's the easiest to see. I can print it out as a paper, but I cannot, you know, make a diagram, you know, and really look at if I have 10,000 of numbers or transactions and I want to just see what are the major patterns here, you know, then I need it in raw format and in a format that I can analyze it and compare it quickly. So we try to push forward that organizations put it as an effort of transparency themselves out. So clients, partners, and who else or beneficiaries can analyze it and, you know, make them accountable.
So should they just put the data out on a web page and, oh, like, would that be the best way rather than putting a PDF file?
There are different approaches. They are kind of called open data portals. You know, Kenya government just recently did a big one, which is very interesting. There are such portals, but there are many organizations that have just an area of their website called data. And then the organization, and then they offer data sets freely available. Interesting stuff about their work, but also, for instance, statistics, stuff which they work in, they put their resources in, but they share it. You know, interestingly, the World Bank, for instance, went to this open data movement a few years ago. You know, as I have heard, the most access or the most visitors go to this data page, not to the normal page.
That was Christian Kreutz from the German chapter of the Open Knowledge Foundation, speaking about some of the challenges of making data more accessible on the internet.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Highways with no traffic jams and only the occasional accidents on the street. It may sound like a dream, but there's actually a new technology that could help traffic moving while saving lives. There's only one snag, though. Automakers and lawmakers have to work together. This report by Gunter Birkenstock looks at how researchers are working on creating smart car and smart traffic systems. The report is presented by Sean Sinical.
In the future, cars will know whether there's a traffic jam looming ahead or whether it will start raining. Basically, cars will be able to figure out the information that you would normally get on the radio or from GPS services using what's called Car-to-X communication technology. It relies on wireless connectivity in UMTS mobile cellular systems. Michael Schreckenberg is one of the researchers at the University of Duisburg-Essen involved in the project.
The technology makes it possible to communicate with traffic lights, to find out how long they will stay red, so that drivers can adjust their speeds accordingly. But the system can also transmit weather information and data on traffic flow.
Car-to-X technology works with sensors, so there are sensors attached to the car and other sensors at various locations along streets. The sensors communicate and continuously send data about traffic flow and weather via wireless networks to a control station, where the information is evaluated and then sent back to the cars. That means that the risk of an accident because of a traffic buildup on a curve can be reduced to a minimum. The car computer can warn the driver that there's a traffic buildup, and cars that have stalled automatically transmit their data to the cars behind them. The technology has developed from a study called Safe and Intelligent Mobility, Testfield Germany, or SIMTD. It's been going on since 2009. Several car makers like Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, Opel, and Ford, as well as mobile communications companies, research institutes, and the German government, which has provided funding for the project, have collaborated on the project. But it will take years before this technology is standard on our roads, says Schreckenberg.
Who's going to be the first to get something done? The car makers, who must equip vehicles with the technology, or the lawmakers, who must see to it that such sensors are installed on street signs, traffic lights, and so on?
But steps have already been taken to turn the technology into reality. Last year, car manufacturers sent a fleet of cars onto the streets to test the Car-to-X technology under real conditions. 120 cars and 3 motorcycles covered hundreds of thousands of kilometers collecting and supplying data using the same technology. That's the central prerequisite for developing an efficient system. And luxury automaker Mercedes has said it wants to install the technology in selected models. But not everyone is enthusiastic about Mercedes' venture. Burkhard Milke is the director of technical development at automaker Opel.
All the advantages that SIMTD offers, that drivers can communicate with traffic lights or mobile construction sites, cannot be found in this solution by Mercedes. That's because communication would only occur between Mercedes vehicles, without being supplemented by data from infrastructures.
In addition, Milke said, developing one's own individual system is disadvantageous for Car-to-X technology to work comprehensively.
The first step of introducing the system should not impede the second step, namely of getting it to become a widespread standard.
And the system will have to have high security firewalls, Schreckenberg warns.
Such systems can also be hacked, and I don't think I have to tell you what it would be like if that were to happen. You only have to picture it in your mind. People hacking into the system and sending false signals. That could happen.
For now, then, people will still have to rely on their own senses rather than sensors to drive their cars. But then again, with most of us unable to read a map and navigation systems now commonplace, who knows what the future will bring.
That was a report by Gunther Birkenstock, presented by Sean Senecal. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Chapana Chimbalu, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can follow us at dw_SciTech. Well, people do talk about sex a lot more than they did in 1991 when that song was released. But the trouble may be that people don't talk about sexually transmitted infections. So perhaps it's no surprise that the awareness of STIs, as they are also known, has gone down in Germany. At the same time, infection rates for STIs like gonorrhea are also rising. In this report, DW's Gudrun Heiser takes a look at the rise of gonorrhea in Germany. Her report is presented by Saroja Coelho.
On internet forums about gonorrhea, it's easy to come across several misconceptions about the disease.
I'd only ever actually heard of gonorrhea in the context of rich business people going to Asia on holiday, coming back and infecting their wives.
That's just one of many comments you can find on forums, but the fact is anyone can catch gonorrhea. You don't have to be rich or in business, and the disease is not confined to Asia, it's everywhere. In Germany, there are between 10,000 and 20,000 cases of gonorrhea every year, according to estimates by the Robert Koch Institute, that's Germany's Disease Control and Prevention Authority. It's hard to say whether this estimation represents reality. Since the year 2000, gonorrhea cases no longer have to be reported to the Robert Koch Institute in most German states. It's also a perception thing. It was thought that age-old sexually transmitted infections like gonorrhea had been brought under control, or that they ceased to exist altogether. But that's not the case. Gonorrhea is now the third most common STI in the world. Professor Norbert Brockmeier is an HIV/AIDS expert at Ruhr University in Bochum.
It's not just gonorrhea. All the STIs are making an unexpected comeback. It's very surprising because, generally speaking, more people are now using condoms. On the other hand, people's awareness and knowledge hasn't declined, so it's more likely to be affecting highly sexually active people, rather than teens or young adults who are having their first sexual experiences and are more prone to STIs like chlamydia and human papillomavirus. The classical STIs are mostly found in men who have sex with men.
The trouble is that most people are unaware of the risk that certain sexual activities pose, as Dr. Brockmeier explains.
The prevention campaigns for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases differ. In some cases, you can become infected by the touch of a finger. If someone has infected vaginal fluid on their fingers, for example, they can infect you with syphilis or gonorrhea.
Gonorrhea can affect the cervix, rectum, throat, and mucous membranes of the urethra. Within a week of infection, men will usually notice a pus-filled discharge oozing from the penis. In women, the infection generally presents itself in a similar way to men, but sometimes women don't experience any symptoms at all. That can cause other problems, as Dr. Vivian Bremer from the Robert Koch Institute explains.
It can lead to pelvic inflammation, then a blockage of the fallopian tubes, which means the woman is no longer able to have children.
If a pregnant woman becomes infected with gonorrhea, she risks passing the infection to her baby. A newborn baby will start to show symptoms within days of birth. Its eyelids become swollen, and the eyes are very sensitive to light. The infection is usually treated with antibiotics. This has been the long-preferred method of treatment. But international monitoring programs now show that the disease is becoming resistant to such medication.
Antibiotics are no longer as effective. You could use more antibiotics, or stronger concentrations. But ultimately, this could lead to a situation where gonorrhea is no longer treatable with antibiotics.
But at present, there are no alternatives. Development of a vaccine is only a distant prospect. Germany's STI Society, the Society for the Promotion of Sexual Health, has published new guidelines on this issue. One recommendation is to administer a one-off, high-dose combination of two antibiotics, ceftriaxone and azithromycin. As well as developing effective therapies, the STI Society is also working on effective prevention, as Dr. Brockmeier from the Ruhr University in Bochum explains.
The Federal Center for Health has managed to get Germany to a point where we have the lowest HIV infection rates in the world. In the past few years, we've been focusing on HIV. Now, though, you'll often see campaigns that address other diseases like gonorrhea and syphilis.
Many people still don't know much about sexually transmitted diseases. They probably aren't familiar with the symptoms or potential risks of chlamydia, hepatitis B, genital herpes, HPV, syphilis, or gonorrhea. Experts say information campaigns are urgently needed, not least because people are far more at risk of contracting HIV if they have already been infected with another STI.
That was Saroja Coelho presenting a report by Gudrun Heiser. While people in Germany try to raise awareness on how STIs, apart from HIV, are transmitted in Africa, the struggle against HIV continues. Though the female condom has been largely ignored by women in the Western world, it has been making its way on the African continent. In Mozambique, which suffers from an HIV rate of 11%, NGOs are making a joint effort in pushing the use of the female condom as a means of fighting HIV. Cynthia Taylor traveled to Mozambique with a UAFC joint program, an NGO consortium promoting the female condom.
It's just past one in the afternoon, and the blazing sun forces the dozens of market people in the Mozambican town of Matola to hide under the shade of their stalls. You can find all sorts of goods on sale here, and all sorts of people too. A great platform for 22-year-old Felix Magul and his colleagues from the youth association Kutenga. They're here to promote the female condom. Felix is one of eight young men who regularly take to the streets of Matola, just an hour's drive from the capital, Maputo. According to data from local clinics, in some areas of Matola, HIV prevalence in women is as high as 23%, more than double the national average of 11%.
We are giving power to women who, in previous time, she was only supposed to use a male condom. So now she has independence that she can use a female condom.
Felix talks to both men and women, demonstrating with a rubber model how to use the contraceptive. He explains that a female condom is a pouch that is inserted in a woman's vagina before intercourse. Felix is a friendly young man with an easy smile, and he seems comfortable talking about sexuality. He's chatting with people as if they were best pals. He makes use of slang, describing the female condom as something cool and fashionable. At the end of each talk, he hands out a female condom to everyone in the audience to try out later. While he says it's the same talking to either men or women, Felix does admit his tone changes slightly for the ladies.
I'm smiling a little bit more than what I'm doing with a man.
So you're more charming when you're talking to women?
Actually, I have to do so.
The women themselves don't hold back either. Some tell Felix they've tried out the female condom.
Was it painful?
No.
Was it less pleasurable?
No. Oh, my, these questions. On the contrary, it's more pleasurable. Mm-hmm.
This young woman says it's irrelevant that Felix is a man.
It's just like going to the hospital. A lot of times when you go to the hospital, it's a man who'll see you. So if I have an infection and it's a male doctor who's seeing me, what will I do? I have to show it to him. There's no other way.
Felix has been volunteering with the youth association Kutenga since 2006, but it's only since last year that he's been promoting the female condom. While it doesn't seem like an obvious choice of job for a man to do, Felix says he enjoys full support from his friends and family. He admits there's a bit of a feminist in him, but that's only because he defends the rights of men and women equally. As Felix makes his demonstrations, groups of people gather around. Some have questions regarding the usage of the female condom. How many times can they use it? What health problems can it cause to men? Is there a danger it will get lost inside the woman's body? Others discuss their views on the matter excitedly.
But prostitution will increase with this.
That depends on the person. If the user wants to use it for prostitution, it's their own problem.
We have to understand what drives prostitution, and it's not the female condom.
Dozens of people are crowded around Felix, eager to talk to him. He says this kind of situation is part of his routine.
Yeah, that is the normal thing. That is why I wasn't afraid, because that is my normal thing. So that, I think that there was almost 10 people. The only problem that I'm facing is that how can I understand why they're all speaking at the same time? That's all my problem.
Although the reception to the female condom among the population seems positive, the contraceptive is still far from reaching the same number of people as its male version. A study by the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, says there's one female condom per 13 women in sub-Saharan Africa, while there are 9 male condoms per every man in the same region. Last year, UNFPA acquired 1 million female condoms to be distributed among Mozambique's population of 20 million inhabitants. And that's not all. The same study estimated that in 2008, only 25% of the female condoms for free distribution in Mozambique reached its users. Nina Yengo is a project officer for the female condom in the NGO Pathfinder. They support 4 reproductive health projects in the area, including the association Felix belongs to. She admits they still face some obstacles in Mozambique.
The female condom doesn't get the same attention as the male condom. Sometimes they're available in the government's medical warehouses for distribution, but they're low priority and delivered last. It's not seen as an important product for medical centers the way medicine is.
Still, Nina finds it successful that since September last year, the projects working with her organization have secured some 450 supporters of the female condom among the 2 million inhabitants of the towns of Matola and Maputo. Commercialization of the female condom is still low. Its price of 50 euro cents, twice as much as its male version, is high for the average Mozambican. Felix is confident about the future of the female condom. He believes it could balance the power relationship between men and women, since women can decide themselves to have safer sex instead of relying on their partners. That's why he'll continue campaigning in the market streets of Matola. For DW Radio, I'm Cynthia Taylor in Matola, Mozambique.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science and listen again and or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Chipona Chimbelu, and our studio technician was Jürgen Kuhn. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Lost in all of our vices, in your purse. tumbling down in the city that we love. Great clouds roll over the hills, bringing darkness from above. But if you close your eyes, does it ever?